first 10, 20, 30 no's, it hurt a lot. Like, I was mad, but I was like, oh, that hurts. And I started feeling down on myself, and I started feeling like, maybe they're right. Maybe I can't do this. Those no's and my fears and everything turned to anger. And then it turned to, I'm going to persevere over this. I'm going to be resilient, and I'm going to prove them all wrong. And then it became a vengeance. And I'm like, what? Like, how does that work? And I realized this just wasn't going to work. And I knew that at that point, there's nobody better to do this and to take my vision where it deserved to go other than me. And that I essentially needed to pull up my big girl pants and learn to do it.
Welcome to The Moment, a new podcast by Canadian Business and Quill Podcasting. I'm one of your hosts, Jason Maganoy, the publisher of Canadian Business, and I'm co-hosting this podcast with Fatima Zaidi, the CEO and founder of Quill.
We're talking about the not-so-glamorous side of startup life, the moments we don't always get to hear about, the time when founders had to make a sharp pivot, start over from square one, or ditch an idea entirely. These are the real stories of what it takes to make it as an entrepreneur.
Each week, we're welcoming a new entrepreneur to talk about that moment where they were faced with giving up or powering through.
Subscribe and follow wherever you find your podcasts. Today, we welcome Bobby Rossette, founder and CEO of Virtual Gurus, a platform that combines advanced technology with human insights to open the door for more diverse talent and give businesses a boost. Bobby isn't just leading a company. She's changing the way that we think about work and equity. As an Indigenous Métis Cree, she draws upon her own experiences to fuel her passion for a more inclusive workforce.
She's helping break down barriers for underrepresented groups to ensure that everyone has an opportunity to have a meaningful career. Bobby is the chair of the board of the Indigenous Prosperity Fund and is also on the board of the TELUS Friendly Future Foundation. Bobby is absolutely committed to creating a lasting legacy.
Hi, Bobby. Welcome to The Moment. Thank you so much for joining us. You've come a really long way from working in the oil and gas in 2016. I know that after a very prominent layoff, you found yourself working at a coffee shop, and it was there that you decided that you wanted to sort of take the plunge of entrepreneurship, which eventually led to the creation of Virtual Gurus. Congrats on the launch of your new product, which I'm excited to talk about later today. But can you walk us through the moment when you first decided to shift from what you were doing to becoming an entrepreneur?
So I actually was working in oil and gas for about 4 years. I moved to Calgary from Montreal, originally from Regina, Saskatchewan. And I got a job in oil and gas, started as a safety technician. So really my role was to essentially sit at the holes in the vessels in the oil and gas and make sure everybody was safe. But throughout the time, I was able to move my way up into a high angle safety foreman. In 2014, 2015, the layoffs happened. So there was, I think, over at my plants, there were well over 100,000 people that got laid off in total. And of course, I was one of them. And so I couldn't find any work. It was about a year, 10 months to a year later, where I started seeing like gig economy, freelancer, and all this kind of fun stuff that I thought, you know, maybe I could do something like that. Maybe I could figure it out. So I signed up to companies who are considered to be our competitors now. And then I threw up a splash page and started Virtual Gurus, but I was the only virtual assistant and the salesperson, the CEO, all of it, doing it all on my own. And I mean, the first year I made over $285,000 in revenue just doing it on my own. But then that's kind of where the light bulb went on. And I thought, oh, I could probably do this and create a platform for tons of other people like me who have been told no. So, yeah. And now I'm living the dream, I guess.
That concept of no. So you made history. You were the first Indigenous woman to secure Series A funding. But that success didn't come easily. So you experienced 170 rejections before you closed your funding round. So what kept you going through all of those no's, and what did those experiences teach you about resilience?
The first 10, 20, 30 no's, it hurt a lot. Like, I was mad, but I was like, oh, that hurts. And I started feeling down on myself, and I started feeling like, maybe they're right. Maybe I can't do this. You know, it took my mom to actually sit me down and say, you know what, honey, you can do anything you put your mind to. She's like, don't let them tell you no. Like, let their nose feel your fire. And so she kept telling me this. And, you know, and what's easier said than done when you really have no money to keep the lights on and you need the technology to run the business. So it was really hard, you know, but then those no's and my fears and everything turned to anger. And then it turned to, I'm going to persevere over this. I'm going to be resilient and I'm going to prove them all wrong. And then it became a vengeance. Like, it became like, I got this and you can't tell me no. And so then I just started going and my personality, my confidence and everything just shifted. And then all I needed was that one yes. That's all I needed. And then I knew everything would change. So once I did get the yes, then it was is so much more different. You know, it was really difficult, but it certainly was a time where I tell people to this day that that part was medicine for me. I'm a totally different person now than I was before because of that. And it's probably a good thing.
Back when I started Quill, which was, you know, feels like a really long time ago, but it was only 2020. I remember knocking on a lot of investor doors like you. I had so many conversations. And what I started to realize was happening is that because I didn't sound and look like the investors that they sort of, you know, had these prescriptive stereotypes of what I should sound and look like, I got boxed into sort of this other category where either I was sort of trying to, I was in their minds fulfilling a diversity quota, or I was losing the part to somebody who looked and sounded more like the conventional tech bro investor. And so I'm curious, and I'm sure you can relate, and I'm sure you can sort of, you know, understand the process that I went through in the early days of starting a tech company as well as an agency. And I'm curious, what were some of the pivotal conversations that you had with investors that helped you refine the kind of investors you wanted to bring on that would align with your values?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, that was actually probably the turning point when I did start having the conversations as to, was I approaching the right investors or not? You know, I was approaching the typical venture capitalist PE type investors, which is great, but they were not the investors I needed in that moment. What I needed was the diverse equality. I needed impact investors. Because ultimately what Virtual Gurus is doing is providing work to underserved communities who have struggled with finding work in their everyday life. And so because we're kind of more of the future of workforce, it's something where I'd realize that I will need to go to impact more. Now, that's not to say I do have venture capitalists that are not impact investors on my cap table now, but I needed those impact investors to really tell a little bit more of the story and to understand the story of margins. Because obviously when you're impact company, you have a little bit lower margins where maybe the typical VC doesn't understand that. Raven Indigenous Capital is somebody who I'm always going to speak about because it was where I saw a Globe and Mail article, and it was the first Indigenous tech platform gets a $1 million in investment from Raven Indigenous. I had so many people sending me the newsletter on that from the Globe and Mail, and they were like, you got to follow up. I cold emailed them right away. Within 5 minutes, they were on the phone with me, and they were my lead investor. So they
changed. You never hear those stories. You never hear those VC stories.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that we need to tell those stories because it goes to show that a lot of people will say, oh, we're impact investors, or oh, we do this or we do that. But do they really? Right. Like they have mm-hmm. to talk the talk on that.
We have a lot of those in Toronto. A lot of we're impact investors, but really they're tire kickers.
So I love you've spoken about this really pivotal career moment for you. And you were at an accelerator demo day. And then you felt like something wasn't right or something isn't right. So you chose to leave before presenting. So despite the risk of how others might view you, you later found yourself, you did it. You presented in front of 8,000 people in San Francisco. You ended up winning that round. So what was that? Can you unpack that moment for us? And do you think that feeling of fear was a necessary catalyst for you in your success later on?
Absolutely. I think fear, discomfort, resilience, everything, anything that you feel in those type of moments is there for a reason. And you need to learn to embrace those moments and try to figure out your way through them. I didn't know that at the time. But yeah, Jason, I was at Arlene Dickinson's demo day and I was in her accelerator. And it was her and like 200 of her closest friends or something. I don't know, but it was a lot of investors. And I'm not a public speaker. I mean, I wasn't at the time. Now it's, I've gotten used to it, but I just couldn't do it. It's just something weird about standing up on that stage and having everybody look at me and me plead my heart out to them, begging them for money. It just didn't sit well with me. Demo days to me are, it's not my favorite thing, and I don't really see value in them. Before my name got called, I just couldn't. 5 minutes before, I was like, yeah, I'm out. I picked up my backpack and I left and hailed down an Uber, a taxi, I think, and went home. I was like, I'm not here. And they're like, Bobby resets. And I was long gone. I think I was halfway home at that time. I didn't feel comfortable doing it. I just wasn't me. And I knew I needed to get over that fear, though. I needed to figure it out because I was going to have to pitch. I was going to have to do that. So out of redemption, I went down to the Global Startup Fest in San Francisco. And yeah, I went on to pitch in front of 8,000 people. But then the week after that, I went on to pitch at Startup Fest in Montreal and ended up becoming a runner-up of the prize and everything. So I put myself and I forced myself to do it. It was really, really difficult, though.
One thing I learned about you recently, and, you know, I can't remember a time before you were the CEO, but in the early days, this actually blew my mind. You hired somebody else to be the CEO of your company. Yeah. And that is just so mind-blowing to me for so many reasons, because I think a lot of people go into entrepreneurship thinking that they'll finally be their own boss. They aren't going to be accountable to anyone. And then eventually when you become the CEO, you realize that couldn't be further from the truth. You are accountable to everybody, your customers, your stakeholders, your investors. But there's a learning curve before you start to realize that. And I'm so curious why you outsourced that role in the early days. Was it imposter syndrome? You know, was it not the right time and you wanted to sort of finesse your skills? And I'm curious because you rarely hear about that.
Yeah. I definitely had imposter syndrome for sure. And the funniest thing was how I found this person was on Kijiji of all places. I mean, that sums it all right there. I actually started thinking I didn't have the experience to do this, but I knew I was onto something. And so I wrote a little article or a little ad on Kijiji, and it was like, here's what I've created. Here's my revenue right now. Somebody come and be the CEO. I can't do this type deal. And sure enough, I had like, I don't know, 25 men. And I'm going to say this with all due respect, 25 cis white male men. So I hired one of them. And he was a good guy. I mean, you know, I there was a connection for sure as far as that. But 6 months in, I had realized that he certainly was not the right person to be doing this. At one point, I'm not trying to talk to you bad about him, we're friends to this day, but at one point he was talking about putting virtual assistants on drones. And I'm like, what? Like, how does that work? And I realized this just wasn't going to work. And I knew that at that point, there's nobody better to do this and to take my vision where it deserved to go other than me. And that I essentially needed to pull up my big girl pants and learn to do it. And it was essentially me saying, Bobby, you got to figure it out. I took it back. I signed up and I ended up going to Harvard. I was doing it full time. And then the pandemic hit. And then I graduated from Harvard during the pandemic. But then I just continued going and going and going and teaching myself to do it. But it was during the pandemic that Virtual Gurus experienced like 600% year over growth. And then we just kept going and going. And so I really pivoted and had to kind of deal with the snowball effect that we were going through. And to this day, I don't regret the decision to have hired him. I more so regret the fact that I didn't believe in myself when I should have. And, and so I think it was that, again, that moment was made for a reason. You know, I needed to learn.
I think that's like so interesting because, you know, I can think of so many examples in my own career and, you know, running Quail, where you're right, the white cis men come to the table with so much bravado and confidence that it's almost like you're gaslit in thinking that they like must be the best for the job. And, you know, oftentimes when I look at my network and the people who are around me, you know, a lot of the folks that are, say, female identifying are so qualified and so good at their jobs. But the one thing is the imposter syndrome. They're, you know, afraid to put their hand up. They're afraid to put take credit for their ideas. They're afraid to advocate for themselves. And I think it's such a steep learning curve for a lot of us that nobody else is going to advocate for you and that you're CEOs of your own brand. And I really commend you for eventually stepping in to take the role of CEO, because look at how far you've brought the company. But I think that mindset generationally really needs to change, that men have the answer to everything.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, it was something, though, if you think about it, it wasn't too long ago. This was only 2018-ish. The difference the tech community has gone from 2018 to now, though, you know, and that's was something I'm super grateful for, because I know that a lot of that I was maybe a catalyst for some of that change, for believing in, you know, me being the first Indigenous woman CEO in tech, you know, believing in the first queer woman that's done this to this and that. And now you see so many people out there doing it. And I'm super grateful for the moments like that, because it was able to make me stronger to be able to move on and do what I'm doing now and not to be afraid, you know. So it's a good thing. It's a good thing for sure.
So you touched upon the pandemic, and, you know, the pandemic being a really challenging time for everyone, but it led to the creation of initiatives like the People Over Profit program at Virtual Gurus. So can you share a moment during that time where you had to make a tough decision? And what did you learn about yourself as a leader through that experience?
I mean, you know, during the pandemic, it was so different for us, because when a lot of my friends' startups were, I wouldn't say shutting down, they were going down. Like it was such an unknown territory for all of us. Like it was so scary. But for us, yeah, we jumped right in, and I said, look, People Over Profit. And I just closed the funding round, my first seed round of the 1.25 million, right when the pandemic hit. It's kind of funny, true fact, fun fact, all the last of my fundraising rounds were during the pandemic, and I was able to close them. But that seed round took me 2.5 years to close 1.25 million. That was when I received 170 no's from investors. I actually took it upon myself to say, you know what, we're going to launch just People Over Profit. What we're going to do is try to give people, especially businesses who can't afford now because they've just laid off all their admin staff because we don't know what's happening. You know, and so I gave all startups free services. And, you know, I had to make sure my investors were on par for that. Like, oh, they just gave me money. By the way, I'm giving away free services. But everybody was really good about it, and they understood. And in the interim time, it actually really helped us, because right after that we just seen like hockey stick growth, so it was good.
Is that offer still on the table? Is that still active? Because like I think we technically would qualify as a startup.
Yeah. No, now it's a little bit different, but we do have our AI VR that you can sign up for free right now.
So I was actually going through the depths of the internet and going through a lot of your social posts, just, you know, getting to learn a little bit more about you. And I actually found something really interesting that I wanted to read out. You said at one point that as a CEO, the drive to prove myself, the pressure to succeed, and the commitment to my team was what fueled my fire for years. But what I didn't realize was how in the background, I was really only running on coals because I wasn't taking time to fill my own cup. After researching burnout, I was hit hard by the realization that I had gone through so many of the stages without even knowing I was sliding down a slippery slope towards total and full shutdown. Your personal mantra has always stated that my company matters, but so does my health, and that resting is recharging, not quitting. And that is music to my ears. Jason and I have actually seen a recurring theme in this podcast season with so many entrepreneurs coming through the woodworks and saying that they started their career with the hustle mentality that life is a race, you go, 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 otherwise you will be outshined by your competitors. And then the same entrepreneurs have changed tune saying that they wish they hadn't worked so hard. They wish they hadn't, you know, missed their anniversary dinners or their child's first play or recitals. And I think that Gary Vee mentality of life is a race is slowly starting to dwindle, and this new generation is starting to realize the importance of being well-rounded and balanced and how that helps you show up to be a better CEO. And so I'm curious, what led to that realization, and how do you sort of come every day to the table to be a balanced CEO, and how does that reflect in the culture that you've built?
Yeah, that's good. I'm glad you found that. That's awesome. I when it really hit me was when I had to do a media, some photos, and they took a photo of me, and I think it went into this with the Globe and Mail. I think it was like the fastest growing startup or something. One of those ones. But I looked at the photo and I was like, what? That's not me. I was so unhealthy. I've lost 200 pounds now, since then. And you know, the issues is during that time, during COVID, I mean, I lived alone at the time. And so you fall into this thing, and then all I had was virtual groups. Like obviously my family, I couldn't see my mom because she had quadruple bypass surgery. And because of COVID, we couldn't chance for getting sick. And it was just all those things. And when I saw that picture of myself, I thought, who is that? Like, what the heck? And I really had to take that clear, true, strong look at myself and say, wait a minute, you're burnt out. Like all I was doing was focusing just on the business for 2.5-3 years straight, never took any time off, nothing. And I had realized that I was at the brink of probably like breaking, and I knew that. So I had to really take a deep look in myself and say, you know, you're going to have to pull yourself out of this. And so I changed everything. I changed the way I led. I changed the way I was. I knew I was angry a lot to my staff. I knew I wasn't very fun to be around with. And I had to work on my soul core before I could share that and be that. And so I'm thankful that my team were very, we'll say, patient during that time. And there is a point where our culture went through a big, we'll say, kind of mess up because of it. And it was because of me. And so I had to take a deep look into myself, and I'm glad I did. Now I'm a lot more healthier and doing healthier things, and I do the work-life balance. I only work Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. Unless I'm actually traveling, speaking at events, which I do a lot now. And I still don't work past that. I still make sure I'm taking time for myself. And I think that's super important.
My question is about, it's about the business. So, you know, in terms of virtual gurus, it's competing against like much larger players in the market. So how do you ensure that your company stood out, and what differentiates you? Like, how do you, like, it's a knife's edge out there. How do you differentiate yourself in the competitive space? And what has been your most effective strategy when it comes to building strong customer loyalty?
There's a lot to unpack. I love it. I think, you know, what makes us stand out is, people know about the virtual guru story. I think, they've seen it, they feel it, they've heard it. And I think people are saying, okay, they're coming for us. Like they're coming in a nice way, right? Like I think they're saying, just to give you an example, my biggest competitor in the US, I always consider myself being the annoying little sister. Like, what are you guys doing now? Tell me what you're doing. And then they would tell me, and then I would go and apply it because they were way ahead of me. Well, now one of them has left that company and now works for Virtual Gurus as this chief operating officer. And now we're one of the biggest brands out there that's doing what we're doing. So, I think it's just living my passion and living this story and not being afraid to live the story of the company. Like all the people working on the platform have a story, and now we're giving them that platform to talk their story. So that's really been helpful too. We want to always be the top virtual assistant business in North America, especially one that doesn't offshore. And so I think one of the things that we got going for us is we're not afraid to have the Google reviews. We're not afraid to listen to our clients and see what are we doing wrong? What can we do better? But we're the only platform that has the technology that we've built. And that's what also makes us differing, because the technology is one source of single truth that's right there. All of our virtual assistants, all of our administration staff, and all of our clients work through that platform. And seeing that and how it's scaled just with that alone, I think is what sets us aside and what gives our customers the validation that they're going to be taken care of.
And I believe last month you launched your new product, and I was actually watching some of the demo videos. I think the one that really stands out to me is, you know, the woman who was booking a hair appointment using the product. And that one was so surprising to me because, like, it didn't sound like a bot or AI. It sounded like I was actually talking to a real person, and I wouldn't be able to distinguish between the person that I was speaking to and some sort of an automated voice recording. So congratulations. I imagine the uptake has been huge, and you're likely opening up a huge market share for yourself.
Yeah, thank you. So we launched that. It's essentially friendly AI is what we like to call it, but it's our AI virtual receptionist, so 24/7. So that lady was actually the owner of the Rebel X hair salon, and we asked her, we did it, and we asked her to call the number as if she was booking an appointment at her own hair salon. She's like, what? This is AI? And she could ask anything. I would like a fade, and I was like, sure thing. And, you know, so you can... you know, do anything with it. So we have mechanics using it to lawyers, to real estate firms, you know, and it's just amazing to see what it's doing. Now, the whole point of that, though, is obviously ethical AI. We don't want it to take away jobs. We want it to create jobs. So we are launching our human-powered virtual receptionist service where eventually you'll be able to press one and talk to a human. And so that is launching pretty soon as well. But that right now is amazing to see it growing, and it's fun. I never thought I'd get into AI, but here I am.
So we're now on to a segment which we call the Founders Toolbox. And this is where we distill all the lessons that the entrepreneurs had learned the hard way. And we ask them for some resources to help them. Like, what resources do you use to help you stay focused and motivated? So, Bobby, what is in your toolbox? And is there a specific thing or things that you lean on when times get tough?
That I lean on when times get tough? You know, it's probably, you know, I mean, I'm going to say this and my wife will listen to it, but probably my wife, you know, when times get tough, she's the one to sit there and remind me it's okay. You know, you're going to make it through this. And yeah.
The rapid fire round, Bobby, is our opportunity to get to know you a little bit better. I don't know if you've watched Vogue 20 Questions, but it's very similar to that with short, snappy answers, no long sentences, first thing that comes to your mind, no time to think. So what's one thing people don't know about you?
That I have a skin disease called polymorphous light erection.
If you had to pick one guiding principle you live by, what would that be?
Empower others by staying authentically bold.
I love that. What's the best advice you've ever received?
Actually, this is from my mom. You don't have to be perfect to make a difference. Just start where you are, use what you have, and do what you can.
What's your guilty pleasure when you want to unwind?
Golfing and traveling, and probably a little bit too much these days.
No such thing. What's something you've always wanted to try but haven't yet?
I want to go on a 2-month backpack trip around Southeast Asia.
Amazing. Describe living in Canada in 3 words.
Expansive, diverse, and resilient.
What is your biggest pet peeve?
Lack of accountability.
And lastly, what is one thing that you wish you knew at 19?
That I could do anything I put my mind to.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings us to a wrap. When I think about Bobby's journey, the word resilience really comes to mind. Let's take the Arlene Dickinson demo day, for example. Bobby was all set to pitch her idea to a room full of 200 of Arlene's closest peers and friends. And before they even called her name, she decided to leave. For most people, that would be the end of their pitching career. But for Bobby, it was just the beginning. Before we knew it, she got back on the horse and she was at Global Startup Fest in San Francisco, pitching her idea to 8,000 people.
You know, one of the things that, you know, it's been I love this about all these conversations, but this common thread of mistakes.
Yeah.
Making a mistake, being resilient in the face of a mistake, making lots of mistakes, pivoting, having lots of fear, taking lots of risks, all of these things. And my question is, how do you do it? How do you experience fear? How do you get through it?
I mean, I think the fear is just sort of like, across the board, unanimously, every entrepreneur wakes up in like absolute petrified fear every day. I think this is a very common theme. There is no plan B. So the option of not making it just like isn't there for me. Like I'm not saying that I know that every idea is the right one, but I have the faith and I trust myself to be able to figure it out. And if I don't have product market fit or the market isn't responding the way that I hoped, I know I'm going to iterate, pivot, not do the same thing over and over again and come back and get it right the second time. In the early days of Quill,
we launched a marketplace, and it wasn't the right call because marketplaces are really hard to scale without capital, and a lot of capital needed, like Uber, Airbnb, Expedia. Like, you think about the successful marketplaces, they took years before they were profitable, and I certainly couldn't bootstrap a marketplace. And more importantly, the marketing industry and podcasting industry specifically was too small from a market size perspective. So I decided to pivot, and that's when we launched the agency, and the agency was a huge success. Yeah. And the reason I launched the agency is in the marketplace, I started paying attention to the data. The services that were being utilized the most were production services, were marketing services, were the actual execution of getting a podcast off the ground. That's why entrepreneurs don't really take the time to celebrate the milestones, because there's no time. We're so busy chasing the next milestone that once you get there, you're like, all right, what's the next goal? What's the next goal? You have to keep making it.
Yeah.
And the fear of not making it pushes you to keep moving forward. So yes, we feel fear, but then there's no plan B. So during our conversation with Bobby, and this came up during the interview, we were both really surprised to hear that she decided in the early days to outsource the role of CEO. It was her idea. It was her baby. It was her company. But she had almost imposter syndrome, where she felt like somebody else would be better suited for the role, and eventually ended up having to step into the role and crushed it.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious, you know, is that common?
Yeah. So that's actually, I've not seen that. Like, I it's always this idea of a founder CEO or a co-founder CEO, just live, breathe, die, constantly listening, constantly searching at the forefront in the details, 50,000 feet in the air. It's hard to let that go. And I think that there's just so much of the success of the business is tied to this individual. It was interesting for me to see her do it so early, but I mean, obviously she took it back. And I think just her realizing that, well, maybe it wasn't the right time, wasn't the right fit, taking it back, and then obviously incredibly flourishing now.
Mm-hmm.
She kind of ended up back on the path that I usually see, which is founders stick around.
Thank you for listening to The Moment. We strive to bring you something different each week because we don't need another podcast with a bunch of finance bros sitting around their microphones talking about dropshipping. Just like the founders we interview each week, we're here for the real talk. Want more? There's an easy way to make sure you don't miss a new episode drop. Subscribe and follow wherever you find your podcasts.
But don't stop listening yet, please. Rate their podcast, review the podcast. We'd love to get the word out. So please let us know what you think. And don't forget to share this episode so that we can learn more from these incredible entrepreneurs and their stories from the moment everything changed.